WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. At the heart of the information age is the computer, and at the heart of the computer is the computer programmer. My guest, Ellen Ullman, is the rare programmer who can eloquently describe what goes on at ground zero of writing new software. Though she's worked in the field for almost 20 years and even takes computers apart and puts them back together for fun in her free time, she also offers a critique of the insidious ways in which computer technology colors our human interactions. Ellen Ullman has worked as a software engineer and now runs her own computer consulting company. She's written articles for Wired Women, Harper's Magazine, and trade publications. She's also a commentator for NPR's All Things Considered. In her new book, Close to the Machine, Technophilia and Its Discontents, she describes how in the midst of writing a software program, human and machine seem attuned to a cut diamond-like state of grace. But this is only one aspect of what Ullman calls being in the code zone.
Well, the code zone, as it's called in there, has two distinct phases. The earlier phase is when you're developing the system. And there, it's a wonderful kind of cool mathematical place. One can get into a sort of lovely obsessive mind state where everything seems workable, the world seems structured and lovely, and you feel you can just get it to work, and one is very, very absorbed into this almost methadrin high of thought. The code zone that opens the book is a very different place. It's the real madness that lives at the heart of programming. We're right before system release, and inevitably at this phase, bugs show up. And some of them are minor, and you just kind of send it out and hope for the best. But if you have what we call level one bugs, these are fatal bugs. That is, they crash the system. You cannot send it out. So in the scene that opens the book, the three of us are trying to shake out some of these fatal bugs. We're in this obsessed state of mind to fix these bugs, which almost feel demonic at this point.
Now, system release, this is what provokes this state, this long, uninterrupted all-nighter period that most people think of when you think of programming?
Yes, that's either before it ships, or, in other words, before it leaves the programmer's hands. And, you know, I think people have this idea that programming is this very logical, kind of boring thing. You know, maybe it would be like accounting. I don't want to say accounting is boring. My father was an accountant, but that it's very regular and that there are clear-cut rules. It does seem that way from the outside, but it's right before the system release that we really feel, we programmers, the strange state wherein what we know to be true as humans and the way a computer functions are really very different things. I mean, we know what we mean, but the computer only can do what we tell it to do. And we think we've given it the right instructions, but inevitably there are flaws. And so you look at it, a bug is unpredictable behavior, unpredicted, unplanned behavior. And at some point, you have to admit to yourself, this isn't my creation anymore. It's doing something, but I haven't the faintest idea what. And trying to find the cause of this, I haven't the faintest idea what, is under heavy time pressure, is what produces this strange, mad state.
Knowing how software gets made, does it make you distrustful of the technology that you use every day, the Mac machines, and you know, making hotel reservations in cyberspace?
Yes and no. Some of the, like making hotel reservations, no. I mean, what I mostly fear about computers is not that there are bugs, because yes, there are bugs, and it's usually pretty clear. The system goes down. You know, you call up to check on your credit card and they say, I'm sorry, I can't do anything. The system's down. But the thing that I worry more about is that the system can't handle the rounded edges of human existence. I mean, we're not like these machines. We want to see ourselves in them. It's very natural that we tool makers would create a wonderful tool and want to see our own reflection in it. But the computer is really not like us. Human beings can function supremely well when they barely know what's going on, when things are half understood, when there's a great deal of ambiguity. I mean, we're almost designed to function well and pick out the one or two little clues we need to operate and ignore all the rest as chaos. Computers are just the opposite. Everything to everything to a computer has to be stated clearly. It has no foreground or background or unconscious or imagination. And so the more and more we're dependent upon computers and what's planned into them, the more this other part of our lives has sort of no place to be. That worries me more than bugs.
Well, you give a very good example of that in the discussion of the program that you are actually installing in the first pages of the book. And it's the beginnings of a citywide registration system for AIDS patients. Yes. And you write that after you create this system, you finally meet with the people who are going to actually use this software, and their doctors, their hospice directors, their directors of women's shelters, and they all have these complaints about the system that are very valid. And you write that in some way that the system has pre-existed these people, and I'd like to know what you mean by that.
I think we'd like to believe that when we design a system for people, we get them in a room and we ask them, gee, how would you like it to be? And it really doesn't work that way. Someone gets an idea to build a system and they hire some technical people. Really, the technical people sort of get started on designing this. And very often the people who actually use it come in later. It's not supposed to be this way, but it often happens this way anyway. So by the time I actually met the people who would use this thing, I already had a sort of fair idea. I had that pretty mathematical idea, you know, oh, it'll work like this, it'll be just perfect, it'll do this, it'll do that. And then suddenly, here are the actual people. And, of course, they bring with them all the rounded edges of regular life and all their objections to all these lovely mathematical structured ideas I've had. And all the ideas that some community task force came up with, some of them rather baroque, some of them rather useful. And this is the disjunction of computer systems. On the one hand, you've got this great idea. You go, oh, it'll go like this, and this transaction goes up here, and it's updated over there. And in my mind, the system exists. And then the people step into the picture, and somehow I have to deal with that disjunction.
And that often happens, that the technology can put the people who will use it at its mercy.
Well, I don't know about at its mercy, because obviously... Well, sometimes, yes. I mean, but the fact of the matter is that programmers have a lot more to do with the systems we're seeing than we'd all like to admit. Certainly, the whole notion of a computer system is something that comes out of people who want to use this technology. In a sense, every computer system has embedded in it a programmer's idea of how to interact with the world. So in a way, we technical people, in designing these systems, are implicitly putting in our own way of life, the way we like to interact with the world and each other, and that is through the workstation.
End users, you write, the people who actually use your programs, are contemptible in programming culture. So does this have fallout, that the people who make computer software have contempt for those of us who will use it?
Well, no, I don't know how many people would admit it. I'm trying to use that a little bit ironically, but there is an upside-down hierarchy in software engineering. That is, the more you do code that's only seen by the machine or other code, that is, code used by other programmers, the more you get to be called a software engineer, the more you get paid, the higher status you have in the profession. As you move into what we call higher level programming, which actually in the world of computers means it's worse. I mean, higher level is bad. Higher level means normal people might use this thing. You're called a programmer. You often lose your credential as a software engineer. And normally you get paid less and get less status. It's quite the opposite of what you would think. Because in a way, programming for other machine processes is relatively easy because you can define both ends of the transaction. Writing something that on the other end of which is a human being is a lot more complex affair. Human beings are more complex. And you can rely on their intelligence, but you also can't rely on them to be structured the way you'd like them to be.
My guest is Ellen Ullman. She is a software consultant. She's written about computer technology for Wired Women, Harper's Magazine, and many trade publications. Her new memoir is Close to the Machine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is software consultant and engineer Ellen Ullman. Her new book is Close to the Machine. You were at one time a member of an underground communist party. Is that right? Mm-hmm. It was an underground group?
It was a Marxist, Leninist, Mao Zedong thought feminist formation.
Okay. Glad we got that straight. How do you go from a Communist Party member to computer programmer? Are the two vocations, do they have more in common than meets the eye?
Well, at the time, I thought it was completely bizarre. I mean, at the time, I just did it. I always been involved in kind of machine-oriented things. I mean, I got out of college, I did video production, and in this party, I did graphic arts and photography and things like that, laying out the party newspaper. When I got out of this, I was a pretty damaged person. This party was something of a political cult, and when I tried to quit, I was expelled in a sort of very painful way. And all I could do then, I just remember sitting there doing symbolic logic proofs, hour by hour, day by day. I found them very soothing somehow. It was somehow to clear away the cobwebs in my soul, I guess, that I was sitting there, you know, taught myself the propositional calculus and worked proofs of that. And at some point I said, okay, now I have to get a job. And I looked in the paper, what do I know how to do? And I knew how to do photography. That's under P. And there weren't too many jobs of that. And just underneath that was programmer. And I said, well, gee, I know how to do that. I'd done some programming, doing computer-aided animation in the early 70s. And, you know, I said, well, I think I can do this. And applied for a job. And the industry was so exploding at the time. The guy who interviewed me said, well, you don't know anything, but, gee, you've touched a computer. You're hired. So at the time, it seemed a bizarre shift. Later, when I thought about it in writing the book, it seemed to me that it wasn't so bizarre, that, in a way, communism and computer programming and the whole technophilia had a lot in common. They both were very much based on the notion that the technology around you defines your consciousness. That's what Marx believed. And this sort of an idea that's come back around, you know, we'll make a new human being on the internet. That sounds like an old idea, you know, the new man that socialism was going to create. And also it's a form of structured thinking. It occurred to me that, you know, maybe Marx's phases of history were just the algorithm of a computer program no one could ever quite get to run. So it didn't seem so strange at all. The Soviet Union and China are run by engineers, and, you know, here I am an engineer. So perhaps it wasn't such a great leap after all.
Well, your industry is full of instant millionaires and very young ones. There's just a lot of money floating around. What legacy do your former politics have for you, if any at all, or what reverberations?
That's an interesting question. At the time, I didn't really know much about the money scene. When I worked for my first startup company, I mean, we none of us believed at the time that the company would ever go public. We, you know, we were given options for huge numbers of shares of stock. We go like, oh, yeah, you know, we'll hang these up in our bathroom someday. And I actually was quite resentful of the venture capitalists who would come every Friday night and exhort us to work hard and work long hours and work weekends and work nights. And, you know, I was feeling like, yeah, well, why don't you come work nights? You know, you're the guy who's going to get rich. And I was actually quite cynical. But later on, as you know, as the company did go public, I didn't become a millionaire. I left the company before I vested all my shares of stock. You know, I got a loft and a car, and I'm delighted to have that. It's strange to see people that I knew, you know, become really immensely wealthy. But the cost in their personal lives, in some cases, was quite high. I know I could not have stayed there the 7 years that would have been necessary to vest all that stock to become an instant millionaire. So, by the way, it's not so instant as you think. I think at the end of 7 years of not talking to people and working 7 days a week at a computer, I'm not sure I would have existed in any way that I would have found pleasant.
You do write a lot about the generation gap in the computer industry. A lot of the programmers are 20-something, and you're somewhat of an anomaly. Now, I can understand why young people obviously are attracted to the industry and prosper in it, but does that mean that older programmers like yourself are considered suspect? I mean, is there a prejudice that you people can't possibly be on top of this industry? It's so hip, it's so now.
Well, a lot depends on the particular environment you're working in. I mean, there are some places like, you know, Sun Microsystems, they have a laboratory thing there, and, you know, to be a senior fellow at a place like that, I mean, you would be expected to have some years on you. But that's almost a quasi-academic environment. I'd say in the day-to-day stuff, yeah. I mean, the young people I meet are like, well, you know, what's the problem with your continuing to learn new things? I mean, you just keep doing it. It's great. It's exhilarating. I mean, they seem to think that, you know, I've just kind of lost it, you know, that maybe if you're over a certain age, you just don't have the fire in the belly or something like that. But I actually have to say that the more thoughtful programmers are curious about, you know, some of the history of their own profession. I mean, there really isn't much new in computing so far. I mean, there are new tools and new particulars, but the profession's been around long enough for there to have been some pendulum swings back and forth from like things like centralization to decentralization and back again. And some of the more thoughtful programmers are a little curious, but just a little. For me, my problem is triple. I mean, when I go into a new contract and have to deal with programmers, I walk in. Of course, I'm sort of dressed up because I'm a consultant. I'm middle-aged, and I'm a woman, and I'm wearing lipstick. And the first thing they do is, you know, think I'm in marketing. And from a programmer, sort of the lowest form of life would be someone in marketing. And so I have to kind of run through a gauntlet to prove to them that I'm actually technical. And that gets harder and harder as you get older, and I get further and further away from having my hands down at the very bottom of this stuff. So periodically, I'm going to have to go back again and spend some time just digging down to the bottom of this big heap of stuff.
The technology changes so fast. Why don't you give us an idea what it takes to stay on top of it?
Now, if I were programming every day still, I would have had to, in the past few years, go through a huge reorientation of my brain. There was a computer language called C, which had certain structured techniques one used to write programs, which was completely supplanted in a couple of years by something called C++. And it sounds like a successor, but it's really not. It's a hugely different way of organizing the logic for a program. It's like you just have to take your brain and turn it completely upside down.
I don't even know what it means to learn so many languages over and over again. But later, in your book, you also describe all of the literature you read every day, the trade journals, the magazines, I can't even compile the list.
Well, I mean, every Monday, these three fat journals come to my door, these trade journals, and they're just chock full of new products and announcements from companies and looks into the future of new versions of things. And I mean, no one can possibly read all this stuff. I mean, you know, what you do is stand there at the counter and flip, 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 and just run the stuff in front of your eyes to see if anything catches. Then there's, you know, the technical publications, Microsoft Systems Journal, or which gives all kinds of internals about Windows, the operating system, The Economist, and just staying up as a human being, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the local San Francisco Chronicle, The Economist, to keep track of what the libertarians around me are thinking about the world. And then there's the web. I mean, there are sites on the web I feel compelled to check daily, and there is a kind of unbearable overload. And at one time, I found that overload exhilarating, actually. I mean, the fact that there was always more coming at me seemed just delightful. I mean, that you'd never run out of this stuff. And learning a new tool was just thrilling. I mean, you take it to bed, read it on weekends, walk around muttering the stuff to yourself. I think what's happened to me is a couple things. One, the computer industry is just thinking in quarters. So there's a lot of change just happening for its own sake right now. I mean, Microsoft does not have to keep changing its object programming model, for instance, you know, every 3 months the way it seems to be doing. There's no good technical reason for that. The other is, well, of course, my age, I suppose. At a certain point, I've been around long enough to see that some of this isn't really so new. It's an old idea come back repackaged. It's not going to save the world. This new technology isn't going to be the end-all and be-all. There's going to be something else behind it. And it's kind of a maturity one gets, you know, when you've been around for a while. The other part of it is just age in any profession. Middle age is a time for me, it's been kind of thinking, well, you know, you get one life, and how are you going to spend it? And it seems somehow very unnatural at midlife to keep chasing after the latest new everything, you know, because you know there will be no end to that, and at the end of your days, you'll still be chasing.
I'd like to thank you so much for talking today.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Ellen Ullman's new memoir is Close to the Machine, Technophilia and Its Discontents. She runs her own computer consulting business based in San Francisco. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.